Hi, I'm Grant Wall, and welcome to the Planet Football Podcast. Brian Strauss and I are back after 5 weeks in Russia, and maybe like you, we're going through World Cup withdrawal. We'll talk about that and other things in the soccer world, including Mesut Ozil and national identity, the U.S. Women's National Team's Four Nations Tournament, Joseph Martinez and Atlanta, our thoughts on the ICC, and both New York MLS coaches leaving while we were in Russia. A reminder, please rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast. It helps people find us. Onward! Let's bring in Brian Strauss from Washington, D.C. I'm here at home in New York. Brian, how are you?
Back in my shorts on my couch.
Why are we here today? Why are you and I not on vacation somewhere on a beach? I'll explain my situation, but like, why are you not on vacation?
Well, I took a vacation in February when I went to Bolivia.
Right.
Because I was kind of like on the verge of having a nervous breakdown.
Okay.
And so then I got back, and then it was just like 3 months of, right, nonstop World Cup, I don't know, mania, hysteria, just complete laser focus, obsession. And so there was no time. I don't multitask. So all I wanted to do was get to Russia and do a halfway decent job if I got lucky and survive and, you know, not get gulagged or conscripted or eaten by wolves. I don't know. I never thought about what I was going to do when I got back. So obviously now I'm back and there's the inevitable complete emotional crash that results from putting every single one of your eggs in one basket for 3 years. So, yeah.
I mean, my own reasoning for not being on vacation is I'm going on vacation August 11th. I'm going on vacation for 3 weeks. My wife and I are going to India, and we are going to totally disconnect from everything in the wider world. Looking forward to that. I do love my job. I have really enjoyed covering World Cup with you and being over in Russia. But I did totally underestimate my lack of desire to do any work whatsoever right now.
So, in other words, the next 2 weeks, I can't add. 2 weeks are just going to be gritting your teeth and sort of like getting through a root canal.
Pretty much. I mean, like I said, I enjoy my job. But yeah, I totally focused on World Cup. I have not taken any vacation weeks this year until now or until August 11th. And I think my withdrawal symptoms are a part World Cup withdrawal, but also like 40 straight days and nights of working in Russia, which was tremendous fun, but also extremely intense. And I think your body and mind afterward just kind of, they want to shut down.
Yeah,
maybe?
No question. Yeah. I was going to try to do a sort of a wrap up review kind of piece. I did something similar in Brazil, but I was still in Brazil. But the whole ordeal of I stayed up all night the night of the final. We recorded our last podcast. I went from your hotel. I walked all the way to my hotel for reasons that I can't even begin to explain. It was a long walk, like at 3 a.m. And then I was up all night packing, getting ready to the airport by 6. And I don't know, like by the time that whole thing was over and I was back in my apartment in Arlington, all the words just fell out of my brain. And I remember on a couple occasions trying to sit there and write, and it was just like dust coming out. Like there was just nothing. I think part of it is the World Cup is so, and I realize that during the tournament, people are still wondering about transfer gossip. And obviously here MLS is going, there's other stuff happening, but to me, the World Cup is so massive and so all-consuming and so important and drives and defines so much of how we sort of perceive the world of soccer over a four-year period. It's the end of so many different kinds of stories and the beginning of so many others that to then sort of start to think about, I'm just not there yet. I just don't care about anything else in soccer right now. I'm still hung up on what happened and why it happened. And I'm still thinking about things that happened during the tournament. I'm frustrated because I want to watch the final. I want to see the final as it was broadcast, and I don't know how to do this. And I need someone who speaks Polish to help me get a scarf off of Polish eBay. And I'm thinking of these things. And obviously you see Mesut Ozil's, what do you want to call it? Diatribe, rant, screed, confession, whatever that was. And sort of that, you see news that comes out that then sort of harkens back or reflects things that happened during the tournament. And that's the stuff that compels me still. I'm going to be on sort of World Cup duty on a mental and an emotional level, I think, for a little bit longer.
Yeah, and that makes sense. You know, I mean, a week ago, we're recording this on Monday the 23rd, a week ago, we were still in Russia.
Yep.
By the way, since our last podcast, late night on that Sunday after the final, I actually got up the next morning and had to write a story for Sports Illustrated, which they put with a digital cover, just kind of looking back at the World Cup. And the second I filed that, I was like, man, I am just done.
And that's what I should have done. I should have stayed an extra day and done my sort of wrap-up review while still there. Because it's really the transition that messes you up. And then it's coming back and it's being here and it's being inside these walls again and sort of realizing that. I mean, for people who know me, like, I've put literally everything over the past 3 years, which have been a waking nightmare, into getting to Russia. It really was the thing that kept me going and was sort of the one light at the end of the tunnel. And so, yeah, I'm really trying to sort of wrap my head around what's next, if anything, and you know, what's going to get me excited and what's going to sort of, and something will, you know, something will happen. It always does. But like right now, I'm still, yeah, my head and my heart and my sort of everything else are kind of still making that transition.
The podcast, I hope, can get you excited, Brian.
I got no response to that.
For you listeners who are still with us, and who may have sort of joined us, I guess, during the World Cup daily stretch of, I don't know, 35 days in a row. We do have this podcast twice a week. Tuesdays, it comes out every week with me and Brian. Thursdays, it's me and an interview guest.
Less therapy involved in that interview, I would imagine, than in this one.
And we'd love to have you continue subscribing. There are some things happening in the soccer world, though, and I just want to address those things with the knowledge of everyone, I hope, that we're sort of just getting back in on reentry here. So we're aware of all this stuff, and that includes the Mesut Ozil. Very frank, very candid posts, three of them, that he put up on Twitter on Sunday, in which he... I wouldn't say retires from the
team.
He German
never used
national
that word.
Team.
Yeah.
Right.
He danced around that word, didn't he?
But he says he's done wearing the Germany shirt as long as he feels like there is racist treatment of him continuing in Germany. And it's just a crazy situation. This goes back to before the World Cup started, when Ozil posed for a picture with Erdogan, the very controversial right-wing Turkish president. Now, Mesut Ozil is German. He is of Turkish background, and he faced a really negative backlash. İlkay Gündoğan also was in this picture, and both those guys were on the German national team. They were getting booed by German fans and friendlies before the tournament, and then when Germany went out in the group stage, a lot of the negativity in Germany, and some of it very racist, very anti-Turkish, anti-Ozil, anti-Gundogan stuff came out and has continued, including from the German Federation president.
Yeah, that's who his ire is real. I mean, that's really where he, you know, he dances around that a little bit and then goes like full on, you know, Death Star laser beam on Reinhard Grindel, who's the DFB president, and just says that his lack of support and his, and I guess he was a politician in the past and was sort of anti-immigrant and just finds the guy odious. And it sounds like what Ozil was really saying is that if invited or selected, he is not going to play for Germany again as long as Grindel's in office.
Yeah, this is one of the greatest players that Germany's ever produced, who still theoretically could play for many more years with the German national team.
29, I think, right?
Yeah.
Let me check. Yeah.
And so, I mean, my thoughts here are, this was one, a complex story. I don't think it was necessarily that wise for Ozil to take a picture next to Erdogan, who's a truly bad guy. I also understand there's lots of factors that go into a situation like that. We saw Mohamed Salah take a picture next to the awful Kadyrov guy, the Chechen leader, when Egypt idiotically decided to base their camp in Chechnya during the World Cup. And Ozil doesn't acknowledge sort of any regrets about that decision. And yet there's also completely no excuse for the response from German media in many cases, German public, people on Twitter to Ozil's situation. And now they've lost him from the national team.
Well, he said it was about respect for the office. That was the way he sort of, I don't know, tried to put it inside some bubble wrap and make it hurt less. Was that, you know, I'm not a politician. I'm a footballer. You know, I would have accepted the invitation to whomever was president. And this is my heritage. Isn't I guess his grandparents were Turkish. This is my heritage, and I would have disappointed people if I had turned down this opportunity. And this is about appearing with the president of Turkey, whomever that may be, and not Erdogan. And, you know, I mean, I guess the same debate happens here about whether or not teams should go to the White House, right? I mean, as the Warriors and the Eagles and some other teams have had this argument about, are you being recognized by the office or by the man who holds it? So I'm not about to wade into German-Turkish identity politics. I don't know the first thing about either of them. But yeah, it seemed Ozil was naive if he, you know, didn't think that this would cause a problem. It sounds like Grindel and the DFB and some others were really, you know, somewhere on the continuum between incompetent and cruel in the way they then respond to this. So this is just going to be one of those deals where there are lots of people at fault in some way or another. The big picture for me is sort of after coming so close, right? I mean, they had sort of this revolution in style, this revolution in approach, in player development, in commitment to youth and investment in youth all throughout Germany, at Bundesliga clubs and at the training and identification centers they built around the country. You had stylish soccer. You had a World Cup champion in 2014. You then essentially had a U23 team win the Confederations Cup. And it just seemed like everything that this federation did was the right thing. And they were so well run and so well organized and so sort of committed to football development that you sort of wondered where the chinks in the armor were going to be. And I did that story before the World Cup about some of that stuff, and then using their partnership, their technology partnership with the San Jose Earthquakes, just kind of to root it in the U.S. a little bit, to make, you know, just because it's kind of interesting.
Another and really well organization, by the way.
I mean. I don't know what to say to that. They're doing some interesting things, and the team they have on the field this season is not very good. And both of those things can be true. I have no idea.
Sorry,
but
to interrupt.
The IT stuff that the Earthquakes are doing is interesting, and is not with the 3D imaging and the machine learning. That's interesting, and I don't know enough about it to know whether or not 3 months after starting that project they should be like winning every game. Like I don't know what the correlation is there, but it's interesting. And the DFB got involved, and it's a window into their thinking, right? The DFB wants to be in Silicon Valley. The DFB wants to sort of be associated with all of these thought leaders and innovators and technology people. And it was just sort of symbolic of their, And when I spoke to Oliver Bierhoff for the story, their desperate attempt to avoid arrogance and complacency. And of course, he brought up the famous Beckenbauer quote about Germany's going to be unbeatable, and how everything they do is designed to get away from that sense that all they have to do is show up because they're Germany, that they're going to just spend more and work harder and experiment more. And then they go out and just completely crap the bed. Like they could not, it could not have been a more dramatic, like right out of the gate face plant. Veterans didn't play well. There are obviously issues inside the team, issues inside the Federation, like everything that they were supposed to avoid, everything that they committed themselves to maneuvering through, they just ran smack into. And that's just kind of crazy to me. That, you know, with all the money and all the time and all the overthinking about arrogance and complacency and ego and personality issues and division, that basically all of those things happened and the entire World Cup blew up in their face.
Yeah. I mean, and there's also something here with the idea of hyphenated identity. And you know, we could sit here and talk about this for hours, but it's...
Let's talk about it for hours.
It's interesting, though, to me that Ozil had sort of a negative response to being characterized as German-Turkish, whereas in a lot of other places, including the U.S., I think there's a real point of pride, and people like to say I am a hyphenated American.
Well, but people said it was that state of hyphenation to whatever extent that it existed. They then blamed that for partially or told, I don't know, depends, but that was seen as a flaw in Germany's preparation and execution at the World Cup. The distraction caused by his photo and his lack of apology, ergo his hyphenation, was part of the reason Germany failed. That's the accusation. And so he's responding, like, how dare you blame the collective failure on sort of the way that I, you know, think about my heritage and identity. And I guess I kind of get that. I guess I understand why if you don't think that you were at fault, why it would bother you when people pin something as sort of significant as this really total failure by Germany at the World Cup. I mean, you don't want that pinned to you. I can understand that.
Yeah, and I get it. I mean, like at the same time, we're hailing France and their multi-ethnic team for winning. It seems crazy that there are large parts of Germany, it sounds like, blaming their failure on multi-ethnicity.
Well, then I guess there's this incident, right, with Trevor Noah, right? Did you see about this? Trevor Noah is from South Africa, and so I guess he did a riff on Africa winning the World Cup. I didn't see it, but I guess the French ambassador to the U.S. or somebody like fired off a note saying, you saying that these men are anything less than French. I'm obviously paraphrasing in a huge way, but you saying that these men are anything less than 100% French are what causes divisions and what causes problems and whatever. 21 of our 23 players were born in France. They were raised and educated in France. They are French. You know, do not try to sow division. This is what sows division. And of course, Noah comes back and says, well, they can be French and they can be African. Both of these things can be true. I'm not taking away from their Frenchness. I'm trying to celebrate their Africanness, et cetera, et cetera. And again, it's just impossibly complex, especially for someone like us who don't live there and have no firsthand experience with it. But big story throughout the World Cup. And obviously you have players of similar heritage with Belgium. This was something that was talked about with England. This is the world we live in now. And certainly we've seen it at home with the U.S., where there have been questions both inside and outside the locker room about the level of commitment and interest from U.S. national team players who may have been brought up or born or raised somewhere else. So these are just things that this is just going to be a constant refrain, I think, as the world sort of, whatever, as cultures collide. It's not going to go the other direction.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me. And you even have differences within Europe. Something Vincent Kompany, my guy, of Belgium said once, I think it was in a New York Times story, he you know, his father's from Congo, DR Congo, and his mother's from Belgium, and he was born in Belgium. He's Belgian. And he said, I don't feel 50% Belgian and 50% Congolese. I feel 100% Belgian and 100% Congolese. And I thought that summed up a pretty good way of thinking about it.
I can't relate. It's fascinating. The fact that it does inspire such opinion and division is kind of fascinating. I mean, I don't care, I guess. Like it doesn't, you know, if I'm a fan of the French national team, you know, how N'Golo Kanté it's interesting and I'd read about it, but it's not something that would change my opinion of the team. If I'm French and I'm happy my country won the World Cup, I mean, obviously the commitment of the players was there. I mean, this was, and that's the thing. I mean, contrasting it to Germany, to some of the other teams, France won the World Cup because because they're loaded, but because Deschamps so successfully got these men to subvert their individual egos for the collective. I mean, there was so much about that team that was about restraint and about deference and about waiting for an opportunity and about sort of playing in support of a teammate, doing some things that aren't necessarily glamorous. From Giroud on back, everybody was asked to do these things. And because they did it so successfully, they won the World Cup. Maybe, and as we talked about over there, maybe having to leave second gear like twice during the entire tournament. They didn't even have to try that hard in terms of, you know, overt effort on the field to win. What they did so well, what took so much work, was that team concept that Deschamps built and the way so many players, Griezmann and Pogba are the ones that really pop to mind, are the ones who sort of gave of themselves for the whole, the collective that Deschamps envisioned. And so here you have a team that, and of course, France has gone the other way too, right? How many times have they had an uber-talented team loaded that basically imploded because they didn't have these relationships, right. They didn't have this chemistry. So we've seen it from France both ways, and now we've seen it from Germany both ways. And it's just fascinating the way human ego and identity and the way we stress about things that really have no impact on us whatsoever can shape or derail a World Cup campaign.
Yeah, no, you're right. What else is going on here? I got a couple things I listed. U.S. Women's National Team back in action. 3 games in the next week and a half in the Four Nations Tournament. Thursday against Japan, 7 p.m. Eastern on FS1. Sunday against Australia, 7 p.m. Eastern, also FS1. And then finally, the following Thursday against Brazil, 8:30 p.m. Eastern on FS1. I'll even be making an appearance post-game with an insider segment this Thursday night. This is all ahead of Women's World Cup qualifying in October. And I think people are getting, national team fans in their World Cup withdrawal are getting excited about another World Cup coming up in less than a year. Obviously, that's Women's World Cup. Fox flew Jill Ellis, the U.S. women's coach, to Moscow. Got a chance to sit down with her on a couple of occasions. And, you know, she's going to have some tough decisions to make. And we talked about that a little bit over there, including whether Carly Lloyd, who was the outstanding player of the 2015 World Cup, will even be on the team for 2019. And if she is, what kind of role she's going to have. I realize that this is not an area you've been covering much recently, but are you looking forward to Women's World Cup, Brian?
I'm looking forward. We had this conversation in 2015. I'm looking forward to the Women's World Cup quarterfinals. wake me for the quarters. You know, I was just thinking while you were talking, is there a way to make qualifying more exciting, more intriguing, maybe you could combine CONMEBOL and CONCACAF. Maybe that would be more interesting. I don't know. I just Women's World Cup qualifying is a week long tournament where, you know, the U.S. beats, you know, Trinidad 8-0 and then there's far more intrigue in the roster selection than there is in either the qualifying, the build-up, or quite frankly, even the group stage of the Women's World Cup. And I have no problem with the Women's World Cup expanding to 24 teams. That's the way you lift the tide. That's the way you get more countries involved. You get more countries to invest in women's soccer. you know, I think we sort of batted around one time sort of the idea of votes for FIFA president or some other kind of thing being tied to a combination of both men's and women's ranking. You know, that there needs to be a way to incentivize more countries to spend more on women's football. There's no question. But at the same time, we're not at a point yet where the women's national team is challenged on a regular basis enough to sort of really start to feel those big game jitters. And so, you know, this is a team for whom the World Cup starts essentially in the quarterfinals, maybe even the semis. And I think that's when I'll start to feel it.
So I take it you did not watch 2010 Women's World Cup qualifying when the U.S. lost to Mexico and had to go into a playoff against Italy and was the last team to qualify for that tournament.
Yeah, I mean, you could never have anticipated. I watched the Italy, but you could never have anticipated that, first of all. So in terms of you know, big game jitters moving into something, you never would have in a million years imagined that happening. And, you know, Buster Douglas beat Mike Tyson. I mean, look, we've had this argument, and my argument has always been that when the U.S. women lose, it is essentially a statistical accident. And that's what that was. I mean, one time, how many Women's World Cups have there been now? Seven? So, I mean, one time they lost a qualifier. And so maybe it'll happen again in 20 years.
I no longer assume that any U.S. team will qualify for a World Cup.
That may be safe. After Cuba, no assumptions. No, I was so obsessive about this summer that I need to figure out what is going on in MLS. I do want to check in with the women and sort of figure out where they are in terms of, you know, who's back, who's not. I want to start being able to imagine a starting 11 for the Women's World Cup. I need to figure out how to get into Audi Field. Like, I had no idea how to do this.
This is the new stadium in D.C. that just opened.
Built this new stadium, and D.C., like, you never know what's going on with them. I haven't heard a word from them. I don't know if I can get in. I would like to hang out there and go watch soccer games there. I don't know if they'll have me. And I have no idea what's going on. So they have a game Wednesday against the New York Red Bulls. We've got Atlantic Cup action at the new stadium down the street from my dwelling, and I don't know if I can go. I want to figure out if I can go. So that's kind of exciting. But I got all these things that have sort of taken the back seat to the World Cup.
No, it's true. I mean, I looked down the list at some storylines in MLS. Joseph Martinez, sixth MLS hat trick over the weekend, all-time record, even though this is his second season in the league. 22 goals in 22 games. Atlanta, the best team in the league points-wise. That's pretty impressive for a team in its second year.
Both New York coaches gone while we were away.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, like,
the Hudson River, whatever it's called, what I don't know if there's an official name for it, the red blue thing, completely changed while we were gone.
So, how do we feel about Jesse Marsh leaving the Red Bulls to take not a head coaching job with RB Leipzig, but an assistant job?
I would love to talk to him about it at some point.
Yeah, we'll have to try and get him on the podcast. It seems like an opportunity, and he's got a 2-year deal over there. And RB Leipzig obviously knows, you know, is a pretty good place to be. It's just a head coach from MLS going to an assistant's job.
If you have ambition to coach in Europe, like many things in life, it's about getting your foot in the door. It's about being there, you know. And he'll be there now, and all of the connections and conversations and pre and post match sort of, you know, handshakes with other clubs and other coaches. And you're now plugged into that network and you're now working with players who go back. I mean, it makes sense. I mean, if he's thinking to himself, you know, this is my entry point. I'm sure his ambition is not to be an assistant coach for Red Bull Leipzig for the rest of his life. So I get it. And he proved himself with the Red Bulls. He did a good job. Obviously the championship is left unwon, and maybe that stung a little bit, or maybe that gave him pause when he made the decision, but he's got a shot to get his foot in the door. And obviously as a Bob Bradley sort of protege, right? sort of maybe to continue some of the work that Bob did in his European adventures and sort of carry the torch there. So I get it. It's a life experience. It's interesting. It's just that here you have the Red Bulls and NYCFC chasing Atlanta. Unless Toronto is able to sort of somehow, and I guess they're getting a lot of guys back from injury, but essentially while we were away, they were terrible. They went from being the best team we've ever seen in MLS to just being like a tire fire. But apparently there were a lot of injuries and they're getting some guys back. And so maybe they make a run and sneak into the playoffs and then they're the team nobody wants to play. But fascinating that the Red Bulls and NYCFC, who are two of the three best teams in the East, and obviously rivals, and obviously sort of there's that narrative there, both lost their coaches to Europe. Obviously Patrick Vieira going to France is completely understandable.
Yeah. I mean, other things I've got here, Kellen Acosta traded to Colorado for Dominic Badji. Wayne Rooney is playing for DC United. Portland's U.S. Open Cup protest against LAFC for using what they charged was an ineligible player, which has now been withdrawn. And Christian Pulisic scores two goals against Liverpool.
He did. Well, Liverpool was wearing purple. I don't know if that counts. Why would you come all this way? And why'd you do? I know the answer, but it just annoys me.
Are we excited about these ICC games at all?
I'll tell you what. I mean, again, it's hard to look. I'm not going to begrudge a fan who wants to go see these teams play and wants to buy a ticket and go. I mean, if you have fun and you enjoy that, more power to you. There's obviously some demand for it. I'm totally cool with that. It does not bother me one bit. But I'm a media person. And as a media person, it became clear to me a while back that these clubs have zero interest in making themselves available or accessible to the media while they're here. They do not care. And so if they don't care, then I don't care. If part of their brand building and part of their storytelling was to make themselves available to us and let us, like, as well, you know what? I'll take that back. Roma did a couple years ago. Roma let me in, and I had a very nice time with Roma, and I thought wrote a story that turned out pretty well. So there's the exception. But for the most part, they make it clear that we're not wanted. So that means that my interest in this is pretty much zero.
I am going down to Philadelphia in a couple hours here to do some Bayern Munich interviews. So it's not everybody that is, as you say. I mean, Roma is an exception. I am doing this event tomorrow night with Liverpool folks here in New York.
Let me rephrase that. They have no interest in me. I am a nobody, and so I am irrelevant to them. And so again, asking whether I personally am interested in the ICC. The answer is no. If you are interested because they know who you are and want you around, then again, that's awesome. And that works for me too because we work together. And so that means SI has some coverage. But on a personal level, they could not give a shit about me. So I'm going to like turn my attention elsewhere. I'll learn about the women's national team or I'll go save the crew.
I hear you, man. That said, I am not going to any of the ICC games, or at least the ones here in New York. I got invited to go out to Ann Arbor, Michigan this weekend by Andy Markovitz, my friend who's a professor out there. So we're going to go to Liverpool United, but I'm not on the clock, will not be working, and looking forward to seeing a game as a fan.
I would imagine that I would have been sent to Madrid Juventus if Ronaldo was going to be part of the tour.
And he's not, right?
Right, he's not. But obviously that's going to be, I hesitate to say here because I don't want to claim anything about FedEx Field, but FedEx Field technically is in the Washington area. But I'm glad, but now I don't think I'll go. And quite frankly, I'd rather like hoof it back to Moscow than go to FedEx Field, all things being equal. So yeah, I think once again, I will skip the ICC. I will not feel bad about it. And like we sort of began the podcast, I mean, I think this is about as much work avoidance as possible until sort of my guilt and professionalism kicks in or until I get yelled at.
Well, this is all about being a pro this week, now that we're back on the case here. But thanks for spending some time with me. It's good to talk to you, man.
All right, dude.
Thanks for listening to the Planet Football Podcast. I'd like to thank Brian Strauss, as well as everyone at Cadence 13 and Sports Illustrated who supports this podcast. Please, if you like the pod, tell your friends, subscribe, like, and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. It really does help the cause if you do. And check out the 30-minute Planet Football video show hosted by me and Luis Miguel Echegaray on SITV. That's available on SI.TV, Amazon, and Fubo TV. See you next time.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.